C.T. Studd, or Charles Studd, was known as the most famous and successful cricketer of his day. He was a cricketer for Christ. And the classic book on his life, which a lot of this presentation is based on, is C.T. Studd, Cricketer and Pioneer, written by his son-in-law, Norman Grubb. But after having produced that, I went back to another book which had had a tremendous impact on my life as a new Christian. I read Reluctant Missionary by Edith Buxton. Now, Edith Buxton was one of the daughters of C.T. Studd. And you'll notice that the notes that I've got for tonight are in two parts. I've got C.T. Studd, Cricketer for Christ, which is based on the one book, and then Reluctant Missionary of Edith Buxton, the other one. And I've tried to merge these two together. Of course, Edith Buxton's got unique insights as the daughter, and she's very cynical, probably one of the most honest missionary biographies I've ever read in my life. Edith Buxton's got tremendous sense of humor, and she was by no means an enthusiastic missionary to start with, and it's actually hilarious reading. But you'll tell the difference, because when we're dealing with Cricketer and Pioneer, it's in yellow, and when we're dealing with Reluctant Missionary, it's in white. So if you're not sure sometimes, am I quoting from Edith or am I going from the official history of C.T. Studd, the difference is between whether it's in yellow or whether it's in white. Edith Buxton was one of the four daughters of the famous English cricketer turned pioneer missionary Charles T. Studd. C.T. Studd had captained the Eton and the Cambridge cricket teams, and he had played for the All English in Australia. He was converted during the Evangelical Revival of 1880. Under the ministry of D.L. Moody. He gave up everything and he went out as a missionary to China in 1885. There he met Priscilla Stewart, and all four of their children were born in the heart of China in the 10 years that they were in China. C.T. Studd was the third of four sons born to Edward and Dora Studd. Edward Studd was dead serious about horse racing. He wasn't content with winning several steeplechases. He set his heart on the Grand National. And he won this race with this horse, Salamander. So he had the champion horse of the country. Charles Studd was raised in great privilege in England. From his earliest years, he was involved in sports, particularly fox hunting, horse racing, and cricket. And this was their home. Aside from horse racing, the Studd family engaged in hunting in the winter, cricket in summer. Edward Studd had a first-class cricket pitch made at the back of his house. His three elder sons grew up to achieve fame in Eton, one of the most exclusive schools in England, by all being in the Cricket 11 team together. And not only that, each one of them captained the Eton cricket team in succession. C.T. Studd's the one in the middle. Charles, along with his two elder brothers, received the most exclusive education in the country at Eton, and they excelled at cricket, and they created a record by each captaining the Eton team in succession, which was an unheard of achievement. Well, life was very pleasant, very comfortable, very promising for the boys until their father Edward Studd heard D.L. Moody, and nothing was the same after their father became a Christian. It was 1876. Edward was invited to hear the American evangelist Dwight L. Moody, and Moody's sermons were described as very much to the point, blunt. Edward Studd was 56 years old when he heard Moody and Sankey's outreach in the Drury Lane Theatre, and it was a decisive experience. He experienced a radical religious conversion, and his whole way of life changed. In order to express his new faith with all the energy and enthusiasm of which he was capable, he gave up all of his questionable pursuits, particularly gambling. He invested his immense wealth and fortune into winning others for Christ. The boys were shocked at the change they saw in their father. He was transformed. He withdrew from horse racing, and then he rode around the countryside to urge his neighbors to come in to Sunday evenings. They came in the hundreds, filled the staircases to the first floor. They leaned over the balconies in his great home in Tedwell to hear any fellows he got to come from London to speak to them. And D.L. Moody himself came to his home, to Edward Studd's home, to preach the gospel to his neighbors. As Edward had never done anything by halves, he now threw himself into the saving of the souls of his friends and his relatives. And the evangelical message of those revival days was forthright. It was delivered by Edward more like a sword thrust than a message. Are you saved? If not, you're going to hell. And that's fact. That's just the way that Edward would preach. He spoke fearlessly to anyone and everyone on salvation. Through trusting in Christ, he gave generously wherever there was a need. Even he gave a house that he owned in America to his friend Dale Moody, and he contributed largely to the founding of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago for the training of missionaries to the foreign fields, which the Moody Bible Institute still does. Edward lived only for 2 years after his conversion, but it was said of him that in those 2 years he worked wholeheartedly for the kingdom of God on earth, and he accomplished more than most Christians do in a lifetime. It's very rare for a person to get saved later in life. In fact, the odds are, if you ask in almost any environment, when did you come to Christ? The vast majority, up to 80%, will raise hands and say, before I was 21. In fact, most came to Christ before they were 16. The overwhelming majority. And with each passing year, you get less and less likely to be saved, because people get more and more set in their ways and more hardened and more difficult. Conversions of people late in life are very difficult. And that Edward Studd could be converted at age 56 was against all odds. Imagine if he'd hardened his heart at that stage in his life. How different history would have been. Not only did he come to Christ, but so did his sons. C.T. Studd studied at Cambridge. And then when his second brother George was seriously ill and believed to be dying, C.T. considered, what is all the fame and flattery in the world worth? What shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? And C.T. Studd had the world. Edith Buxton describes her father, who was known by his initial C.T., as the third son of Edward Studd. Interesting, Edith was the third daughter of C.T. Studd. C.T. captained at the Eton 11 in 1879 and at the Cambridge University 11 in 1882. Later, he is an English team that went to Australia and it retrieved the ashes. It defeated the reigning champions, Australians, and brought the ashes home to England. C.T.'s team returned in triumph with the urn. Charles' fame grew and he is twice declared to be the best all-round cricket player in England. Now, in this one, C.T. Studd's the one standing at the back right. In the previous picture, he's the one right here, sitting with the arms folded. That's C.T. Studd. And that's the All-English team. And this is the All-English team. This is the Cambridge team. That's correct. Charles Studd had the world at his feet. In this one, you can see he's in the middle at the back. While on a cricket tour in Australia, and his brother George coming close to death for a severe illness, it deeply affected Charles and made him think about eternal matters. Edith remembers her father describing his conversion in these words: I had the good fortune to meet a real, live, play-the-game Christian. It was my own father. But it did make one's hair stand on end, the way he witnessed. Everyone in the house had a dog's life of it until they got converted. He was always asking about our souls, and we did not like it. His brother George recovered, and C.T. Studd went to hear Moody once again, and as a result, he gave up cricket. He dedicated himself to saving souls. Attending this meeting of Dale Moody, C.T. Studd was brought to a position of full surrender to Christ, and from this point on, his life was never the same, and he is possessed by a consuming passion to lead people to Christ. Now, his father had brought him to Christ 6 years earlier, but he now regarded the first 6 years of his Christian experience being in a backslidden condition where he was selfish and he didn't witness to others. But now he yearned to be absolute in his service for the Lord. C.T. shocked his family when he became one of the famed Cambridge Seven missionary volunteers of the China Inland Mission. He met Hudson Taylor, and he answered the call to be a missionary to China. In this, he is joined by six other Cambridge students, or graduates, who made a huge impact on the secular and religious world, becoming religious celebrities of their time, and they were known as the Cambridge Seven. He chose to join Hudson Taylor's mission to China, and C.T. was described as no orator, but he had a tireless and a forthright manner of speaking, meaning he was very blunt. These are the seven Cambridge 7, and CT Studs the one at the top. These seven young aristocrats, two of them famous athletes, another two military officers, forsaking the comforts of England to work with an until then unknown missionary society in the hinterland of China, was a story the press could not pass up. And the Cambridge Seven helped catapult the China Inland Mission from obscurity to embarrassing prominence, and it inspired hundreds of other recruits for CIM and other missionary societies, until by the end of the 19th century, China Inland Mission was the largest mission in the world, with something in the region of 1,000 full-time missionaries in the field. Stanley Peregrine Smith was the captain of the Cambridge rowing team, and so he is one of the most famous men in England. He is a superstar in sports. He has also converted one of D.L. Moody's revivals and helped found the Cambridge Christian Union. Stanley Smith was the orator of the seven. He is the best speaker. Dixon Hoster was the son of a major general and an officer in the Royal Artillery himself. He was also converted during D.L. Moody's campaign. He gave himself to Christ as completely as he'd given himself to soldiering before. Cecil Polhill Turner was an officer in the Royal Dragoons, and his brother Arthur was studying to become a minister. Arthur's the one seated, Cecil's the one standing. And William Wharton Cassells was an ordained Church of England minister, and Charles Studd was the most famous of all. He was the unbeatable cricket captain, the most brilliant member of a well-known cricketing family, one who was almost uniformly expected to score a century any time he's out there batting. With much fanfare, these missionary celebrities toured the British Isles, attracting huge crowds, much media coverage, and perhaps some of this went to their heads, because on a long boat trip to China, they refused to study, and they prayed to receive the Chinese language supernaturally. Hudson Taylor warned them that this was one of Satan's devices to keep the Chinese people ignorant of the gospel. When they finally reached China in 1885, and the Chinese language hadn't miraculously descended upon them, they decided to finally knuckle down to study and open the books, which was a bit of wasted time on the long sea voyage out there. In China, they were immediately struck by the degradation that opium had dragged so much of the population down to. Many people sold everything they had for drugs, furniture, roof tiles, agricultural tools, even their wives and children. They sold them to slavery to satisfy their craving for drugs. So debased were the common people. One of the strategies of the Cambridge Seven was to seek to reach these opium addicts for Christ. Here they would just come to receive opium and just lie on these benches in a stupor, stacked up there. And so they established opium refuges where addicts could come and stay for 3 to 6 weeks and find deliverance from their addiction. Each of the seven reacted very differently to China. William Cassells, the ordained clergyman, was appalled by the lack of church rules within CIM, and within a year he and Arthur Polhill Turner left CIM to found a Church of England diocese in Sichuan. Cecil Polhill Turner also left after a year and became a wandering missionary, with the goal of being the first missionary to Tibet. Stanley Smith was soon casting out demons and offended the local Chinese Christians. He abandoned the unobtrusive style of CIM evangelism and began parading through villages with banners and gongs like a Salvation Army band. He eventually embraced the Buddhist ideal of a larger hope that all humanity will somehow be saved, and ultimately Smith departed so far from the doctrinal foundations of the China Inland Mission that he was compelled to resign. Dixon Hoster was the most stable and successful of the seven. He stayed the course. And he was a wise and patient missionary, and he served the Chinese with great distinction, and he earned their love and trust, and Dixon Hoster actually succeeded Hudson Taylor as the next director of the China Inland Mission. Now, it's worth mentioning this because you often hear about the celebrities like the Cambridge Seven, but you don't always hear what actually happened to them individually thereafter. They might have all had a good send-off and a good start, but it's not how well you start the race, it's how you finish the race. Charles Studd married an Irish Salvation Army officer, Priscilla Stewart, and from the beginning they suffered severe persecution, and he later reported that for their first 5 years in China, every time they stepped out of doors, they were greeted with curses from the hostile Chinese. Now, to cope with such hostility, a sense of humour is essential, as seen in these examples. C.T. Studd presented this parable. Remember the miller's donkey. The miller, his son, the donkey, went to the market. The miller rode the donkey all the way, and the people exclaimed, "Cruel man, riding himself and making his son walk." So he got down the sun road. Then the people said, "What a lazy son for riding while his poor old father walks." Then both father and son rode, and the people said, "Cruelty to animals, poor donkey." So they got down, carried the donkey on a pole, and people said, "Well, here are two asses carrying another ass." Then all three walked. And people said, "What fools to have a donkey and not ride it. So, let's get ahead with our work for God and not care what folks say." And that's the sort of way that C.T. Studd spoke. C.T. Studd said, "Had I cared for the comments of people, I would never have become a missionary." So he didn't care what people thought about anything. Nevertheless, Charles saw many people converted, and he saw numerous opium addicts delivered. His total dedication to CIM's principle of living by faith, China Inland Mission was the first interdenominational mission and the first faith mission. When he inherited a fortune, at age 25, C.T. Studd came into complete control of effectively £25,000, which would be millions of dollars in today's value. And he promptly invested it all in the Bank of Heaven, as he said. He gave away his entire inheritance as gifts to the Salvation Army, D.L. Moody's Bible College in Chicago, and to Muller's Orphanage. He regularly preached Christ as though he had never preached again, and as a dying man to dying men. D.L. Moody's Bible College, George Muller's Orphanage, and General William Booth was able to send 50 Salvation Army missionaries to India with the sponsorship of C.T. Studd's sacrificial gift. By the way, C.T. Studd wanted to set apart some of his fortune for his wife and children, and his wife said, "No, I'm going to live on faith as well," and they gave it all away, kept nothing back. When after 10 years in China he was invalided home with typhoid, his friends doubted whether he would even reach England alive, and people said, "There goes a dying man." But C.T. did recover, but he suffered with asthma for the rest of his life. You would have thought with asthma he could have been excused going back to the field. In spite of his physical strength as an athlete, Charles did not enjoy good health in the mission field. So it was 1893 that he almost died in China, and his forced return to England with his wife and his four daughters. Grace is the oldest, Pauline's the youngest, Edith is the one who's giving us a lot of the story here. When in 1895 they finally got back to England, arriving back from China, his family tried to persuade him to join the Church of England, the established church, but he dug in his heels. Father was not like that. He was not a man to join one particular church. He believed in any church or community who loved Jesus Christ in sincerity. C.T. Studd is very unconventional. He travelled around Britain. He stirred up interest in missions. In 1896, he was invited to the United States to help launch the student volunteer missionary movement, out of which grew the student Christian movement. He stayed in the United States for 18 months, touring from one side to the other. This was not an easy place to travel across back then. They were still having dirt tracks and railway some places, most of it by horse and cart. He sometimes addressed as many as 6 meetings a day. Many hundreds offered themselves for missions as a result of his dynamic ministry. But in 1900, C.T. Studd moved to India, and there he pastored a church for 5 years. He actually moved to the area where his father had made his fortune in India as a planter. And he joined a cricket tour in order to have more opportunities to preach to British soldiers scattered throughout India. In India, he had the privilege of baptizing his 4 daughters. And one of those present at the baptism service was the famous Amy Carmichael. Edith Buxton describes this Indian summer as our happiest childhood. There were picnics, badminton parties, outings, morning rides, horseback riding, 2x2 with father. Father was keen that we should excel at outdoor sports, and he did his best to make riders out of us. These were days of monsoon, days of brilliant sunshine at an altitude of 8,000 feet, which was pleasant weather rather than the people who were down close to the coast. Sometimes they saw tigers in the jungle nearby. Ill health again forced C.T. Studd to return to England, where his sporting fame still enabled him to draw crowds. Now, these crowds he addressed in his usual blunt manner. "I once had another religion, hunting the Bible for hidden truths, but no obedience, no sacrifice. Then came the change. The real thing came before me. Soft speech became crude salt. The parlor game became real cricket on the public grounds. Words became deeds. The commands of Christ became not merely Sunday recitations, but battle calls to be obeyed. A simple creed was born again into decisive action of obedience. Now, upon their return to England in 1906, the girls were shipped off to school in Switzerland. Interesting enough, although her parents were poverty-stricken, her grandmother cared for them and made sure the girls did not suffer because of their parents' extreme faith living and squandering their inheritance in their minds, and so the grandmother ensured that the girls received the best education and better standards of clothing than they would have had otherwise, and so on. So they had to go to Switzerland, where girls learned how to be ladies, and they learned French there. And as Edith put it, born in China, home to England, 5 years in India, followed by one half in Sweden, and now Sherborne. She describes feeling guilty that she didn't want to follow her parents. Secretly, I felt at war in myself, undecided, reluctant to throw in my lot with them. Yet I felt a stranger to the world that was shouting its welcome. And poor father groaned when he took us out, because being a missionary, it was not seemly to have such daughters. As to jewelry, we could never pass a shop without flattening our noses against the windows. Dorothy was always the favorite anyway with the boys. I felt life was simply not worth living unless I could gain the same attention. There were constant jealousies between us. We were often at loggerheads. We had come to love the sounds of London. Edith Buxton describes the years leading up to World War I as a brilliant decade of strawberries and cream and cricket matches and large hats and lace umbrellas and night parties. And her elder sister Grace was always protecting us and, if need be, taking the blame. And because of their pranks, there was lots of blame to be had. In 1908, in Liverpool, a notice caught C.T.'s eye. His friend, missionary Karl Kumm from Germany, was advertising his meetings with a poster which declared, "Cannibals want missionaries." And Charles laughed and thought, "For more reasons than one." C.T. Studd determined to take up the challenge. His doctors were against it. His wife was against it. His financial circumstances were against it. But he was convinced that God was for it, and that was enough. Muslims were sweeping down over Africa, making converts. And unless a chain of mission stations were made across the center of Africa, nothing else would stop the Muslims. Father wanted to start the first mission in the middle of this chain, plumb in the heart of Africa. He took a map, he drew a line from top to bottom, from side to side, and he said, "That's where we're going, right in the middle." And he called his mission the Heart of Africa Mission. As Edith described it, it sent my grandmother crying and my mother weeping silently on the third floor of Hyde Park Gardens. Her helpless cries of, "Oh, Charlie, how could you?" were to no avail. He set about speaking everywhere that he could get an opening in order to collect recruits. No offer of speaking did he turn down. He slept anywhere. In 1910, at the age of 50, he left alone for southern Sudan to explore the possibilities in equatorial Africa, and he joined the famous Church Missionary Society missionary, Bishop Llewellyn Gwyn, after whom the Bishop Gwyn Bible College in Sudan, which became the frontline mission base, was named. Bishop Gwyn is a famous name in Sudan because he did so much to establish a church in Equatoria, and he is the first Anglican bishop of Sudan. And so C.T. Studd, pictured here, traveled with Bishop Gwyn all the way down the Nile, and he came all the way to the places where we have done our work in Equatoria and Sudan, as far as Mundri and Meridi. And he even considered establishing his base in Meridi, but there was too much malaria there, and he decided against it. Out of the 29 donkeys that went on this expedition, 25 died. That's how hard the journey was. But out of this journey, the vision for the Worldwide Evangelization Crusade, or WEC, was born. He came back to England as a man on fire, and once more his students were aroused by his meetings, and he wrote booklets in his usual hard-hitting, straight-from-the-shoulder style, including The Chocolate Soldier. Christ's call is to capture men from the devil's clutches and snatch them from the very jaws of hell, to enlist and train them for Jesus and make them a mighty army of God. But this can only be accomplished by red-hot, unconventional, unfettered Holy Spirit religion, by reckless heroism and sacrifice in the foremost trenches. This message stirred up antagonism as well as inspiration. However, his doctor declared him medically unfit for any kind of missionary work. But his great saying was, "If Jesus Christ be God and died for me, no sacrifice could be too great for me to make for him." In 1911, he presented his chocolate soldier message at Cambridge University, where, of course, he was one of the most famous graduates alive at that time. The dons filed out in silent disapproval, but the undergraduates were intrigued with his audacity. Edith comments, "To me, my father's goings-on were quite incomprehensible. As a family, we had had enough adversity. To go out and seek more was sheer madness. There is no doubt that he was a man of extraordinary vision and compelling presence. His messages were charged with challenge, humor, and emotion. But it was his realism and living out his own message that attracted those who were looking for sincerity in a world of fashionable poses." It was at this stage that Edith's fiancé, Alfred Buxton, who was staying at Cambridge studying to be a doctor, volunteered to join C.T. Studd's Heart of Africa mission. He is the only volunteer. Edith unknowingly took him to one of her father's meetings, and he was the one volunteer that went forward, and she was so angry. She didn't want to talk to him. And he headed out with her father. Naturally, this caused a hue and cry in the Buxton family, who had said how unwise it was to go with this harebrained man, as some called him. At the farewell meeting in 1913, at which C.T. Studd and Alfred Buxton were to speak, C.T. spoke with his usual aplomb and zest. The difficulties were great, but he didn't care a brass button. As Edith commented, "Off to Africa they went, one too old and one too young." In 1913, he set out again for Central Africa, accompanied by his youngest daughter's fiancé, the young Cambridge graduate Alfred Buxton. Together, they were the pioneers of the Heart of Africa mission, which became Worldwide Evangelization Crusade, which in time became the largest mission in the world itself. They followed in the footsteps of Henry Morton Stanley through Kenya and Uganda to northeastern Congo, going to the very tribe that tried to eat Stanley when he was coming through. Soon Edith was again in the swim of my frivolous life. Tea as you only find in Scotland, scones of every kind, butter in glass dishes, homemade jams and cakes baked to perfection. Fun and laughter were everywhere, life was bright and gay. How easy to stay and be caught up in this life of grace and ease. But she felt she had to prepare herself for the mission field. She is starting to calm down about what her fiancé had done, so she volunteered to work in the Salvation Army Mother's Hospital, depicted here, and worked in the wards for 6 months. Learning all I could, in the first baby case I attended in the theatre laid me low on the floor. She fainted. So she didn't think she'd make a very good nurse. Landing at Mombasa, C.T. Studd and Alfred Buxton travelled by bicycle throughout the Congo. Father had trained his mind from early days to look upon every problem as an opportunity. In fact, I've known him to say that he welcomed tight corners, if only to see how God would get him out of them. "Bicycles," cried the trader. "So you mean to say you're going to bicycle through the jungle?" "Certainly," said C.T. "We will get from one end to the other more quickly, and when they can't carry us, we will carry them." He had an answer for everything, and a faith big enough for every situation. On the incredible trek across the continent, they faced cannibals, wild animals, tropical diseases, the maddening zing of mosquitoes, strange night sounds, the fierce Balenga tribe who had killed Imran Pasha, who had been rescued by Stanley, but later went back to the same area and ended up in their stomachs. They were warned that they would never get through the Balenga tribe alive. Hair-raising experiences such as that of an English elephant hunter who had recently been shot with a poison arrow by the Balenga and died failed to deter C.T. and Alfred. "They'll be too interested in our bicycles to do anything to us," he said. Massive trees, so tall that they turned the midday sunshine to twilight. Vegetation steamed with heat. Monkeys swung and gibbered at them. The myriad sounds of tiny insects, birds and creaking branches. They felt as though 1,000 eyes were staring through the thick bushes watching them. They were lost in the primeval forest. They met with cannibals with teeth filed down to sharp points. They suffered repeated bouts of fever. C.T. referred to the fevers as like being repeatedly ducked by the devil. The fever mounted. The weakness increased. All medicines failed. "If there are any sick, let them call for the elders of the church and let them anoint them with oil. But where's the oil? Neither salad, olive, or even linseed oil did we possess. What's the matter with lamp oil? Why not? It's oil, and that's all the book says, and we can't afford to be narrow-minded. CT Stud then recorded, this I knew, next morning, that whereas I was sick, nigh unto death, now I was healed. They walked through the Uturu forest, where Stanley once travelled. The forest was very beautiful in places, like marching through an endless cathedral. They travelled through territory where a Belgian officer with a troop of soldiers had been massacred to the last man by the cannibals. To these very cannibals, CT and Alfred preached. Their first baptisms took place in crocodile-infested river. While the missionaries were baptizing the candidates, they were having to fire into the water to keep the crocodiles at bay. C.T. Studd did the baptism with his Webley revolver in one hand, firing coolly while he was pronouncing the in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. As he suffered malaria and other attacks, he wrote, "Some like to live within sound of church or chapel bell. I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell." And he wrote that while he was in the Congo, in the heart of darkness itself. In 1916, he came back and he left England for the last time, taking with him a party of 8 missionaries, including his young daughter Edith, who was coming up to marry her fiancé Alfred Buxton. Later, another daughter, the youngest, Pauline, with her husband Norman Grubb, who famously took over the mission and ran it very well, joined the mission. Soon the number of missionaries had grown to 40. Edith Buxton describes herself as a very reluctant missionary indeed. When she was 24 years old, she joined her father on the SS Elizabeth to travel to the Congo to marry Alfred Buxton. "I'll die. I know I'll die. I shan't be able to stick it," she said. At one of the first services in the Congo, she remembers the words of one hymn. "Death cometh once. Hear now his tread. Soon shall you and I be lying, each within our narrow bed." She remembered wondering which one of us death would pick out first. During the eventful 4-month journey up the Congo River, Edith lost her engagement ring. While she was throwing the water from a wash basin overboard, her engagement ring flew off her hand, plopped into the mighty Congo River, and she felt this was a bad omen. More than 4 years had passed since I'd last seen Alfred. Incredibly, immediately I held my breath. So acute was the anticipation, the dread of what I might feel. However, the reunion was warm and better than anything she could have ever expected. In the 4 years, she had grown to forgive him, and imagine being separate for 4 years, and then they finally came and made good their engagement. After the river journey, there was another month of trek on foot. If you were to draw a line through the centre of Africa from north to south and again from east to west, there would be Nala, which is where they were going. She found Nala a clean, tidy, well-spaced village. Avenues of palms grown years ago by the Belgians, interspersed with small and big houses, a church, and a schoolhouse. These were all built of mud and thatch, in the simplest of fashion. All this had been Alfred's work. And into the bargain, he had completed the first stage of writing the Bangala vocabulary. These are the same Bangala who had been the worst enemies of Stanley in his battles down the Congo. They sometimes travelled by canoe and passed herds of hippopotamus. They then had to trek to Nyangara, where the Belgian district commissioner was waiting to conduct the first white wedding in the heart of Africa. So far, the Belgians were not permitted to have their wives and children with them, because this part of the country is not considered civilized enough, which was still inhabited by cannibals. Father was blatantly unconventional. The church at home, he had thought, had become more of a building than a way of life. He had not been ordained. He read in his Bible, which was his constant guide as to how the early Christians went about things, and he would do the same. So that he baptized, dedicated, married, and gave communion, and buried them in a simple African village church. Morning prayers were at 7 a.m., when the whole village would turn up. Work began at 7:30 or so. They would raise the roof with the hymns of Moody and Sankey, translated into Bangala. Once a man got up and told us a story with such relish that every head turned in his direction. I was so interested that I turned to Alfred. "What is he saying?" Alfred replied, "He has just told us he's sorry. He has to confess he has eaten his uncle." The prayer meeting every Friday night was a thing to remember. Outside in the dark, the palm trees rustled gently in the evening breeze. Inside, you could see some 200 bowed figures, the oiled bodies shining in the light of the palm oil lamps. Gimisi, the converted cannibal and ex-soldier, was the church warden. He would take upon himself the duty of prowling around, and if by any chance he caught anyone with their eyes open, he'd give their heads a good duck and tell them, That is no way to behave in God's house. When a man went on praying too long, carried away by the new wonderful experience of talking to God, my father would say, "Now we'll sing a hymn while our brother finishes." Father always said that as long as we missionaries travelled first class, lived out of tins, ate bread and butter and drank tea, the world would never be evangelised. We learned from the Africans how to make oil from flying ants. We also made sugar from sugarcane. We took to making packing cases into furniture. We were always warned not to get so posh that it would make more barriers between us and the Africans. Aside from cannibals, there were occasional incidents with leopards, crocodiles and snakes. After a leopard seized someone, C.T. Studd took to sleeping with a pistol under his pillow. At the end of his second year in Africa, Edith's daughter Susan was born. I don't have an early picture of her, but that's Susan late in life, and that's the son of Edith and of Alfred Buxton. And so Susan was the first white child born in the heart of Africa in the Congo. C.T. Studd took an original precaution. He had an arrangement with the drummer of each village between Nala and Nyangara, where the only doctor was. After Susan was born, Africans swarmed to see her, gazing pop-eyed on the first white baby they had ever seen. Mm-hmm. Susan was a very aware child. On one of our journeys by canoe, she shrieked like a 16-year-old every time we shot the rapids and whirled into the cascading torrents. Can you imagine going by canoe down rapids with a baby? Ganutu was a big, strong Azandi who walked 200 miles to come and hear about God. I have always wanted to know about God, so my wife and I packed up at once, and here we are. When is the first lesson? He never missed a meeting, whether the early morning one with the workmen, or the Friday night prayer meeting, or the Sunday services. He was always there, sitting quietly with an intent look on his face. Soon he was taking part in the prayer meetings. His prayers were short and eager words. I felt the presence of God amongst us in the quiet night. He rose quickly to become a leader, and finally became head of the boys' school. Edith also related a story of a man at Ibambi who had died and was being carried to his grave when he sat up with cries of terror, everyone scattered in every direction. The man told a story. "I've been with God. He knew my name. And that I had heard the gospel at Ibambi. God said, you shall go back to your village for 10 days. Send for the preacher, accept the message, and then you will come back to me." 10 days later, he declared, "Now I'm going back to God." Then he very simply lay down and died. Jabori, an Azandi chief living near Nala, relates to Alfred that one night, many years before the missionaries had arrived, God had met him in his sleep and said, "White men will come. They will come with a message from me. Listen carefully. Do what they tell you. Until then, only do what is right." Another man, Maiai, had no ears. One day Edith could restrain her curiosity no longer, and she said, "My eye, where are your ears?" "Madam, I've eaten them." "Eaten them?" "What?" "Yes, eaten them," said my eye calmly. "Long years ago, I was a slave in a chief's village. My life was hard. I did much work. I was never paid. One day I talked with one of the chief's wives, and together we decided to run away. The chief sent the soldiers after us, and a big pot was put on a boil, and I saw the woman laid on the ground and dismembered limb by limb. And limb by limb she is put into a pot to boil in front of her own still conscious eyes. Slowly she is caught and boiled up to be eaten, and it was my turn next." Suddenly into the circle comes the chief's head wife. Gesticulating widely, she says, "Oh, chief, it's not good to eat a child. Curses will come upon us. We shall die." My fate was turned. Instead, the chief gave judgment that I'm to eat my own ears. Ah, mama, it was terrible. I was very, very ill for days. These sort of stories you're not going to get in any missionary books, but Edith Buxton is just honest, and she just gives you an insight to another age. One Sunday evening, word arrived that Nancy from the girls' school had been caught by Chief Abangama on her way back to school. "He has kept her prisoner. We have already been to the village to demand her back, and he will not let her go." Nothing appealed to my father more than an adventure of this kind. He immediately ordered the alarm to be blown on a bugle in the centre of the parade ground. It wasn't long before all the Christians of the village poured out. Father, from the top of the steps, addressed the eager crowd. He was no pacifist, but on this occasion he ordered everyone to lay down their weapons and go to the rescue of Nancy as Christians, not as soldiers. There was a murmur of disappointment in the crowd. It must have been an hour's trek through the forest before we came to the chief's village. Before long, our arrival, we had heard the drums beating and the grunting cries of the dancers. As we approached, we saw a circle of about 200 men dancing, oiled bodies gleaming, and a bunch of feathers on every head. They swayed in time to the drums. Father orders men to break through the circle, and we all poured after him. They stopped opposite the chief, and Father, seizing the chief by the beard, demanded the return of Nancy. The chief backed away, saying, I'll fetch her, but Father, not to be taken and followed in pursuit. The Christians fell upon the tribesmen with their bare fists. There was never heard such a thumping and pounding. In the darkness, all you could see were feathers of the warriors and the flying shirt tails of the Christians as they laid into one another. One of the chief's wives made her way on all fours through the melee of legs and reached Father, when she quickly took his little finger in her teeth and bit it as only a cannibal can. I gave her a thump which sent her sprawling in the dust. Nancy took advantage of the noise to escape back to Nola. Okay, and I don't think you're going to get testimonies like this written about often in prayer letters. As Edith said, there's no place like Africa. Finding out. An inner voice began to speak. What are you doing? When man listens, God speaks. God can speak to the human soul through the enlightened conscience. I began to put things right as far as I could see, and with my obedience to what I believe God was trying to say to me, there came a change, a sense of God's presence. I experienced a new peace and relaxation in the battle of life. She described Alfred as with such quick intelligence, able to work 16 hours a day, able to eat anything, sleep anywhere, do without anything. We had 6 years of complete and happy companionship. But then he suffered from epilepsy. And after his illness, there followed 16 years of ever-deepening anxiety, sleepless nights, and further attacks, which Alfred took with a silence and a courage that was complete. Father had made such sacrifice of himself that it was in his nature to expect much from others, and most of us could not keep up with him. If missionaries did not come up to scratch, Father felt that we were better rid of them. Alfred played the part of the peacemaker. The same thing happened in cases where African Christians had fallen to sin. Father would demand the necessary church discipline. Alfred would advocate patience and love. Each was representing the truth of the gospel, but the differences became severe. Without holiness, no man shall see the Lord. Father had been trained in law, and his letters could be very severe. He would not be put off his calling by anyone, not even his wife. My father once said, you needed only 1 inch of theology to every foot of practical Christian living. At 70, he mastered King Wanda, and he's able over the years to progress in the translation of the New Testament, the Psalms, and extracts of Proverbs into Kingwana. In 1928, C.T. Studd wrote, as I believe I'm now nearing my departure from this world, I have but a few things to rejoice in, and these are these. Number one, that God called me to China and I went in spite of the utmost opposition from all my loved ones. Number two, that I joyfully acted as Christ told that rich young man to act, which is to sell everything. Number three, that I deliberately at the call of God when alone gave up my life for this work, which was to be henceforth not only for the Sudan only, but for the whole unevangelized world. They called all this area Sudan. Sudan just meant the inland of Africa. My only joys are therefore that when God has given me work to do, I have not refused it. To this end, Charles maintained a strenuous routine. He worked an 18-hour day. He undertook long journeys, preaching sometimes to congregations of 2,000. He read the Bible for hours each day and he poured his heart into prayer. Then the news arrived that his wife, who had been left behind in England because of ill health, had died. Charles now suffered several heart attacks and gallstones. In July 1931, this gallant and very unconventional cricketer's innings came to an end. In 1931, in the Ituru Forest, where he had once been entertained by cannibals, he died. He died the good soldier he had lived, surrounded by the African people he loved, and whose lives he had done so much to change. It was a stormy day when they laid him to rest. 2,000 people from the surrounding forest came to his funeral, including chiefs. In assessing this incredible, bold, abrasive, and controversial missionary, his co-workers, including his two sons-in-law, Alfred Buxton and Norman Grubb, recognized that his energy, his earnestness, His single-mindedness made him a most difficult person to work with. He was stubborn, he was inflexible in what he required and what he demanded of others. He was eccentric. He wrote a booklet where he said he didn't give a damn. The title of it was the DCD. He was a member of the Don't Give a Damn. And he didn't give a damn about anything except serve Christ and to save souls. And that kind of language was most offensive and unacceptable to many at that time, as it would even be to this time, but even more then. I can't abide cowardice, he said. I refuse to make my God and Savior a non-entity. He was ruthless in the standards he set for himself and for others. He interpreted leisure and recreation as idleness. He laid a powerful emphasis on the need for holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. People were not sure what to make of a man who in his 50s could leave behind an ailing wife while he went to be a missionary in the most inaccessible part of the earth. His love for Jesus Christ was supreme, and to many of his contemporaries he was a fanatic. And one of the books written on C.T. Studd is Fool and Fanatic. The mission he founded, WEC, has grown to be one of the largest missions in the world today. And the life of C.T. Studd will always remain a challenge to those who seek an easier path. Edith Buxton writes, C.T. Studd's life stands as some rugged Gibraltar, a sign to all succeeding generations that it is worthwhile to lose all this world can offer and stake everything on the world to come. His life will be an eternal rebuke to easygoing Christianity. He has demonstrated what it means to follow Christ, without counting the cost and without looking back. C.T. was essentially a cavalry leader, and in that capacity, he led several splendid charges. When C.T. and Stanley Smith went with the Cambridge 7 to China in 1885. 10 years later, when C.T. toured the universities and started the Student Missionary Volunteers. And when in 1910 he initiated the campaign for the region between the Nile and Lake Chad, the largest unevangelized region in Africa at that time. These three things alone have affected missionary history. He personified the heroic spirit, the apostolic abandon. From him I learned that God's idea of saint is not a man primarily concerned with his own sanctification. God's saint is 50% a soldier. So the main thing is the fight. Anyone can be brave once. It's sticking to it that counts. There is a price to be paid for dedicated, selfless service such as Father and Alfred gave to Africa. And one of the most famous quotes of C.T. Studd is, "Only one life, it'll soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last." Well, a lot of this lecture is based on Reluctant Missionary by Edith Buxton, one of the most delightful books I've come across, written in 1968. And C.T. Studd, Crickerton pioneer, one of the most famous and favorite well-read missionary biographies of the 20th century, written by a son-in-law, Norman Grubb. I have a chapter on C.T. Studd in The Great Essential of Missions. I would like to acquire this book on Alfred Buxton, also written by Norman Grubb. There's some great books on Hudson Taylor, of course. We'll look at Hudson Taylor in future time. There's interesting books on Henry Morton Stanley, like Heroes in Africa, and The Congo for Christ, The Congo by Henry Morton Stanley. These are some of the old classics. And our materials to help train people to follow in their footsteps as missionaries, you'll see a lot on the Frontline website. And our theme still is Africa for Christ. So, any comments or questions? Yes, please. Comments or questions on C.T. Studd?
What a wonderful story.
It really is extraordinary.
Yes, yes, it's dramatic.
I don't think I've ever read a more honest, insightful, and humorous missionary biography than that by Edith Buxton. She just gives insights and honest stories and testimonies that I don't think you'd get anywhere else. Just gives an insight to a life a century ago. Very, very different from what we experience today.
That Lady Buxton home, which is here in Newlands or wherever, is that named after her?
I don't know, but I've been in the Buxton home, which is today a Bible college, with many international people just outside of London. And I visited there and ministered there back in 2005, which is fascinating. And they've even got CT Studs Chinese outfit. And that's where Edith's husband was brought up, and where they all went into apoplexy when they heard about their son joining this harebrained fanatic to go out into Africa. But that family is so dedicated that they dedicated their beautiful home and estate to being an international Bible college, which is a very dynamic place in England today. But no, I don't know if it's the same Buxton's, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's the same family in general.
How long would CT Stud have worked and lived in Africa?
26 years in Africa. That's right. He put 26 years into Africa. No, am I right? Sorry. He put 21 years into Africa. 21 years into Africa. 5 years, 5.5 years into India, and 10 years into China. No. What happened was, at one point, his wife came out close to the end of her life and his. She came out for a short visit in the Congo. And she was shocked at his deteriorated health and trying to plead for him to come back, but he wouldn't be persuaded. She ran the home-based mission back at home, but they were effectively separated for most of the last 20 years of life. For the last, he didn't see her at one point for 14 years. And that was not considered unusual at that time. Now, you know, today when you look at this, a lot wells up and you're saying that's wrong. But one needs to understand that in Victorian England, it was expected that your duty came first. And no one would have thought of a man as a bad husband or a bad father for going away, whether it was military or missionary duty, for years and years. That was just considered, well, then, you know, duty. You know, if you abused your family, you'd be considered a bad parent. But just absence for the father was never considered bad in the Victorian era in England. 19th century England, this is not considered that bad. But he stretched it at that age to have gone. And CT Studd came under a lot of criticism for having gone out to Africa when he was actually so invalid himself. I mean, here he is with asthma and all these other things. And can't he serve God in some healthier climate? He goes to the worst, toughest, roughest, most inaccessible part of the world to minister. And of course, people kept thinking he's a fanatic. But imagine what an impact he made, because he had everything in terms of fame, fortune, wealth, success. He's the best sportsman of the national sports of the British Empire at that time. He throws it all away and he says, it's nothing. I count it as dung. But for the glory of gaining Christ, and he just, I mean, he's about as single-minded, as fanatical a missionary as you can find. If you think one of the sickliest of the reformers was definitely John Calvin. John Calvin was sick most of his life, but didn't stop him being productive, incredibly. And C.T. Studd had to have been one of the medically weakest of the missionaries, and yet he worked in Africa for a long time. Many people healthier and stronger than him died early. Here he is in the heart of the Congo, and who would have thought he could have survived another 21 years there? That's absolutely extraordinary. And that's after having, he's mastered Mandarin, he's ministered in Chinese for 10 years, come back. Reassimilate to India, come back. Minister in Europe and America. Then go to Africa and learn new languages. In the last years of his life, he's age 17, he's still learning another new language to start another Bible translation project. That's just incredible. This is somebody who went above and beyond. Just as he astounded everyone at his cricket, he astounded everyone at his innings in missions. He just kept batting away. But again, he's doing everything out in the bush, and he wasn't doing it the easy way, he's doing everything the hard way. And, you know, to expect everyone, that you couldn't even have the normal luxuries. You've got to live as close to how the Africans are living as possible, and you've got to just, you know, make do. And I don't think they were ever well supported financially.
I just think we all have far too much.
Well, it's just another era. But the other thing that comes to me when I look at these people is indignation rises within me. The amount of rubbish I've heard at missions conferences slandering the missionaries of the past, as, you know, they're all bad and insensitive and hard and nasty people who offended the locals. And Africa's littered with the graves of missionaries who gave their lives and died early in order that the people of Africa could have the gospel. I think they are the greatest generation imaginable, the 19th century missionary movement, who achieved so much, and yet virtually every missions conference I've ever been to, which we didn't organize, but we just went to, they have slandered the missionaries of the past. And people like Nico Smit, the Dutch reformed missiologist from Stellenbosch, when he slandered the missionaries, unbelievably, shockingly so. And I remember the first missions conference I went to, and I was one of the junior organizers on the committee putting it together, and there we were at the student consultation on frontier missions at Krugersdorp, and our key speaker was Nico Smit, I heard, was this wonderful evangelical Dutch-formed missiologist. I discovered that quickly. And he stands up there, and the first plenary session, he says, the missionaries came to Africa and taught that Africans didn't have souls, and that they were the firewood of hell. And I was too new and young a Christian to know how unacceptable and shocking my action was, but I stood up in a plenary session and said, I was right there in the middle of the middle in the plenary session, said, which missionaries taught this? Did CT, that was the first name that came to my mind, because I'd already been through Hospital Christian Fellowship, and this was required reading under Francis Grimm in Hospital Christian Fellowship. And I said, did C.T. Studd believe this? Did Mary Slessor believe this? Did David Livingston? Who believed this? And not them, he says. And he started to give some story about some heartless people in some Dutch form church he knew who didn't know the names of their servants. And I said, I don't know what that's got to do with the missionaries who came to Africa in the last century and gave their life. Didn't many of them die bring the gospel? Why would they have done that if they didn't believe the people of Africa were souls for whom Christ died? Now, I didn't know much about I didn't know much of the history, but I'd read a couple of books here and then. I'd read the life of C.T. Studd, and I just remember being outraged that this man could be poisoning the minds of a whole new generation of missionaries, trying to give them the impression that these people who succeeded in converting cannibals to Christ, that there's something wrong with them. You know, these wimps wouldn't have even gone, let alone succeeded. And so that's why I think it's important we know this history, to counter the guilt manipulation and disinformation of a new generation who want to suggest that everything of the past is bad. And I'm convinced it's the other way around. Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Noble Savage, the more primitive you are, the better you are. The more civilized you are, the worse you are. The real enemy is civilization. We need to all abandon clothes and civilization and just merge with the savages, and that will be somehow more noble. And that's their way of thinking. There are people who actually believe that, even up at UCT here.
It's that the missionaries brought oppression. That is what they
But that will only work if you've lived in Cape Town and all you know is what you've got from TV, and you go up to UCT, you could believe that rubbish. But if you understood just some of the insights that Edith Buxton gives us here, people who'd been boiled, cooked, eaten, forced to eat their ears, you know, and you get to understand what they've been saved from, what existed before the gospel, then it puts things into perspective. Sure, C.T. Studd was a hard man. He must have been difficult to work for. But no softy could have survived or achieved what he achieved. If he came with a kind of soft evangelical message that the average person gives today, it wouldn't have impressed these people. Mm-hmm. Now, by the way, I know the Azande. They speak about the Azande. The Azande are mostly in Sudan, and I've ministered amongst the Azande in Sudan, and Yambio, Maridi, that's Zandiland. And so some of the Azande are in Belgian Congo, some are up in Sudan. And so the Azande, we know they're big, tough, strong warriors, and that's rainforest territory. So it's where C.T. Studd was ministering is not even 70 kilometers from where our mission base was based in Sudan. It's that close. It's just, you know, just across the river. It would be 2 hard days' walk to get from our base to his base. That's how close. He's that far north in the Congo. And he seriously considered making his base where we ended up working, except he said the malaria was too bad on the Sydney side. Not that they separated it in words at that stage, it was still mostly, they still thought of everything in Sudan, as you saw in the way he wrote. But This people, the Zandi, were fierce warriors. They built an empire. They conquered so many other tribes. They were almost like the Zulu. They were hard, tough fighters. And he brought Zandi to Christ. He brought Balanga to Christ. The toughest warriors that Stanley ever fought, he said, were the Balanga. And Stanley would have had trouble believing that they would have got converted so soon. But C.T. Studd achieved what he achieved because of the work of people like Henry Morton Stanley, who laid foundations before him, who achieved what he did because of what David Livingstone laid before him. So you can see it's like a relay race, a marathon relay race, passing the baton, and the next generation's got to run with it. So I think, for example, when I go to the Africa School of Missions and lecture them on missions history, I want the students to know these stories. I want them to understand the personalities, and that's why we deal with these case studies, and that they can get the grasp of what was going on before the gospel came to Africa and how the first missionaries succeeded and what they did. Because if we're to do a good job in this generation, we've got to toughen up. And the message has to get some steel and fire in it, because what they're giving at the moment is not working. It's wimpy and weak and weedy. It's like diluted lukewarm tea. It's not strong enough. And man like C.T. Studd's message, that's why the chocolate soldier. Yeah, I encourage you to carry it with you this week and read it when you're in a queue or have some time, because it's just straight from the shoulder, punch in the jaw, kick. You know, it's no holding back type of message, because C.T. Studd had contempt for spineless Christianity, this weak, what we today would call even jellyfish. Fillet of the spine.
How do you find the balance between, being zealous or obedient and, you know, works, like just working for your salvation? Or that, you know, some people might argue and say, oh, but he was religious. I wouldn't say that, but I recently actually read a book, it's also like a called Grace book. And a few weeks ago, I think, you spoke about that one guy. He gave all his money away. He was known for that. He was a very rich man, and he gave all his money away. And they just commented there that he was, this writer was saying he's religious in doing that. He didn't trust in Christ. You know, how do you balance?
Well, there must be a balance. We don't do good works to be saved. We do good works because we are saved. The point is, are you doing this to earn your salvation? Are you doing it because you're so overjoyed and grateful because you are saved? Mm-hmm. And plainly in C.T. Studd's life, he didn't think that, he wasn't doing this like some Catholic monk trying to earn a salvation. He was so rejoicing in how God had saved him, and he was so concerned for his neighbor that in loving God and loving his neighbor, he just couldn't hold anything back. He was wholehearted in cricket and he was wholehearted in missions. Mm-hmm. And I don't detect anything in the writings of C.T. Studd that he's earning a salvation, but that this is just the fruit of a grateful heart. Whoever's been forgiven much, mm-hmm. loves much. Freely received, freely give. That's, I think, the idea. So the balance must be, if I think I'm doing good works, I'll become proud, I'll be patting myself on the back and like, oh, I've got a good job I've done. Mm-hmm. But if I see my sinfulness and depravity before God, and His love and kindness towards me, even while I was a rebel and while I was a sinner and while I turned my back on Him, while I was hostile to God, when I was His enemy, He died for me. And out of gratitude, I surrender my life to Christ and I want to serve Him wholeheartedly. There's a totally different attitude there. So I think what we see in these missionaries and the reformers is the fruit of gratitude. They're so grateful for what God's done for them, they just can't stop and they can't hold back and they can't keep silent. There is a need for balance, but we certainly got overbalanced in the wrong direction at the moment, like not offending people.
I keep on, wherever I go, it's like, there's someone says, it's all grace, you are, it's all grace, and then the other one says, no, stop being so weak, so, you know, recently I'm just like, what's going on?
Okay. Let's be balanced like Jesus was balanced. You get grace and truth. You get love and mercy, but you also get truth and rebuke. Some of the hardest words of rebuke were told by the Lord. The Lord spoke on heaven, but He spoke even more on hell. He how do you deal with the Pharisees? He's gracious with the repentant woman caught in adultery, but he's merciless in condemning the self-righteous hypocritical Pharisees, such as Matthew 23. So you can see this balance. The Lord had gracious words to say, but then he had other words said, like things that cause people to sin are bound to come. But woe to the person by whom they come. It's better for him that a millstone be tied around his neck than be cast in the depth of the sea, than he caused one of these little ones to stumble. And hard words like that were spoken by Christ. Better pluck your eye out than let your eye lead you into sin. A radical statement. So you think of how John the Baptist or Elijah spoke, and then we realize that, look, there's a place for mercy and grace, and there's a place sometimes for straight speaking. And it can't be that all at any one time. There's a time and a place for both. Although I don't know how balanced C.T. Studd was. You know, he obviously went the other side. I don't think, in my reading of missionaries, I can think of a more extreme, harsh, fanatical, over-the-top, unconventional missionary than C.T. Studd. He really, he takes the cake and the cup. There's no one who is as extreme as him. And the missionary I was pioneered under, I was mentored under, was Francis Grimm, who pioneered Hospital Christian Fellowship. And C.T. Studd was definitely his favorite. I mean, he kept putting forward, and we all had to read C.T. Studd books, and Fool and Fanatic and Cricket and Pioneer were first things put in our hands when we arrived. So it explained why the mission I was mentored in did what they did. It was all-night prayer meetings. It was first hour of the day was prayer. It was half an hour prayer after every lunch. He'd drag me out of bed at 2 a.m. and say, your desk's untidy. What if the Lord comes tonight? You must be ready. And, you know, things like that. Move those rocks from that side of the garden to the other. Move them back again. You know, that sort of... He would just test and push. And one day he sent me to have a haircut 3 times.
Wow. What
was next? Yeah, each time, that's not short enough. Go and have another haircut. Get another one. And he would just keep you off balance. He was always pounding his standards. And his chapter and verse that he'd quote was C.T. Studd. He would give examples like that, and he didn't put up with nonsense. But he planted 100 hospital Christian fellowships in 100 countries in the world. You don't do that by being nice. So there's a place for these people. Now, people like C.T. Studd are not called to be counselors in... it's not the sort of person sitting in a coffee bar and listen to people pouring up their hearts. You need people to do it. The people have got... This is a man who's got a kick down the door.
And he probably wouldn't have become so tough himself if those Africans had not been so particularly tough.
Yeah. Well, again, you think just in our country, we've got the Zulu, who are tough. They were tough people. And God sends missionaries like Erle Stegum.
Yeah.
A man who gives a tough message for tough people to bring them to Christ. And these hard, tough, violent Zulus have come to Christ. And by the thousands. That wouldn't have been done by some how to win friends and influence people, polite person using positive thinking. It's just they needed a warrior, someone who would step on toes and offend people. But God uses that too. There's many different people in God's kingdom. Yeah, anyway, any other comments or questions?
That husband of Edith Buxton, you say he got sick? Did he
epilepsy.
Not live very, did he not live long?
He didn't live a full life, but he certainly survived the Congo, and he went on to pioneer Abyssinia, and he was translating the Bible into Abyssinian language, and he had to flee when the Italians invaded. In 1935, was it? Or 36, when Mussolini invaded Abyssinia. And he was in there, and he was staying ahead of the Italians, and I think he even spent time as a captive over there in Abyssinia. So he was separated from his wife through no fault of his own by that. And interestingly enough, there was one point where they were pleading with C.T. Studd for mercy on somebody, and C.T. Studd believed that Alfred and Edith were being too weak, and he cut them out of the mission. So even so, they both greatly respect him. And Norman Grubb got hammered and tongue-lashed by him many a time, but he wrote the most positive book on C.T. Studd and cricket and pioneer. The thing is, while they recognised the man's a hard man to work with, but, you know, the man of God, and God used him mightily.
Mm-hmm.
Alfred Buxton achieved a lot in Abyssinia and the Congo. It's a pity he had to go and start his own mission later, because he wanted to stay under Wick, but C.T. Studd just, he is relentless, and apparently got more and more dictatorial and arbitrary the older he got, which probably also understandable. And in the end, he didn't listen to his board, he didn't listen to his wife, he didn't listen to anyone. He was just, he really was a DCD. He didn't give a damn about anyone, and didn't give a brass button about anyone's opinions, and he just ploughed on. And but, you know, the Africans respected him, and the cannibals came to Christ. So, you know, you look at this, and I think, I don't know that I would have wanted to work for him, but one can certainly admire him. But I was mentored by someone who is like one of his disciples. Francis Grimm really quoted from C.T. Studd more than any other missionary. This was the ideal held up at Hospital Christian Fellowship. And we all suffered as a result.
Do you teach how to unlock that as well?
No, I don't. But I'd be tempted to. I must say, if we were in a mission station in the field, we'd have very different rules probably from being a mission base in the city, where most of the people live out and don't live in, and there's, you know, you've got staff versus missionaries, and so there's different standards. You can expect more of missionaries than you can of staff. So, in some ways, a little disappointed about that. But, you know, when we've got a chance with our mission teams, we're a bit harder and tighter on them, because we want them to achieve more. Yes, I'm, as you can tell, this mission station is named after David Livingston. He's my ideal. C.T. Studd is someone we admire, but... we would not want to live under that kind of rule, personally.